Deborah Fairlamb is a founding partner at Green Flag Ventures, a business fund investing in the future of Ukraine. Since 2015, she's specialized in investments and business development in Ukraine, with a particular focus on the tech sector and startups. We're going to be talking about the resilience of the Ukrainian economy, the importance of the tech economy, and how tech is supporting the war effort, and how entrepreneurs are lending their minds and inventiveness to the goal of Ukrainian victory. Welcome to Silicon Curtain. Please like and subscribe and definitely comment against the videos. It really does help them move up the rankings in YouTube, and it helps more people to discover them. Also, please do check out the validated Ukrainian charities that appear in the description of the video. It is incredibly important to support Ukrainians and help them remain resilient in the face of Russian aggression. Deborah, welcome to the channel.
Thank you, Jonathan, and greetings from Kiev.
And it's a sunny day there, just as it's a sunny day here, somewhere outside of Oxford. So that's something at least to be thankful for. Well, let's start with the big, broad picture, and that is economic resilience. I read an article in the Kiev Independent, and there were some extraordinary facts and figures in there showing the expansion of the economy and even the growth of inbound investment. So what is going on here? How is this possible in wartime?
So there's a number of different factors, I think, that are driving this. And I think one of the big ones that you can start from is sort of a psychological perspective. You know, what is happening in Ukraine right now is impacting about 18 to 20% of the territory in the east. And that essentially means that there's still 80% of the territory where there are Ukrainians who are doing everything they can to support those who are at the front. But what they also are doing, and that they really understand, is that the rest of Ukraine needs to remain economically strong. And so in the context of a focus on continuing to drive the economy, to continue to maintain the stability that a good economic footing provides for Ukraine, not only now during wartime, but looking towards the future in peacetime, there is this is almost a mission for everybody who is not directly fighting at the front or doing direct support of what's happening. And if you sort of look at the economic trend over time, you know, just starting with things like the GDP number, in 2021, the GDP year over year growth as a percent was 3.4%. In 2022, it was down almost 29%. It was a negative 28.5% loss, I think it was. But by 2023, it had actually jumped back up to 5.5%. And it was kind of funny, even through the course of that year, in the beginning, if you looked at the World Bank and IMF predictions for what the GDP that year was going to be, they all started in the negative numbers. And then, you know, each month they would revise their forecast upwards as it became very clear that Ukraine was completely bucking the trend of what was anticipated in terms of the economy just being really badly hit. And Ukrainians have put a tremendous amount of effort into continuing to keep the economy moving. And that's both internally, but as well as exporting. You know, there was a lot of talk around the grain shipments and continuing to keep those moving. And it's not just the economic portion of it, but it's also that Ukrainians were really cognizant of the fact that a lot of their grain products were feeding, you know, others around the world, and the need to keep that moving. And so when the negotiations with the Russians really didn't go anywhere about keeping a grain corridor open, in theory, there was an agreement, and then the Russians blew right through it. The Ukrainians, more or less, to your point, used innovation and ingenuity and decided to clear the grain corridor for themselves. It was a very big part of the, you know, I think it's the third of the Black Sea fleet that is, you know, now in the submarine class, as sometimes referred to. But what that has done is allowed the Ukrainians to keep doing all of their exporting through the Black Sea. So it's things like that that they have really continued to focus on, as well as just with all of the other businesses that can continue to grow. Consumer spending is up. Bank deposits are up. Confidence is actually up. They track business confidence here on a monthly basis, and business confidence is still on the optimism level. So there is a lot that is from the psychological level. In terms of what are some of the things that are feeding this, the currency, the hryvnia, has been very stable. That actually absolutely is an important factor in contributing to business continuity. There has been very low inflation. The inflation numbers keep dropping in Ukraine. In 2022, when the war started, inflation hit 20%. It was actually almost 20.21. This year, it's anticipated to be 5.5, but actually just last month, the month of March was only 3.5% inflation. And so the inflation is low, the currency is stable. The exports have continued both through sea, but they've actually continued into Europe by rail. So all of these things are sort of the mechanics of what keep the exports growing.
Now, a lot of the story, of course, of the early stages of the war focus on the failure of Russia to take Kyiv and implement regime change. But is it possible to say that actually their biggest strategic failure was not to focus on that area of so-called Novorossiya, which was to take the southern Black Sea coast, push on through, take Moldova? They would have then had a stranglehold over Ukraine. Ukraine would be in a far more parlous position now if Russia had been strategically intelligent.
So I can't speak necessarily to Kremlin think in terms of their strategy, but I completely agree with you. I think psychologically, Kyiv was the prize. And if you go back to, you know, some of the facts that emerged when, you know, after the Russians had made their first push towards Kyiv, you know, they had come in and they were clearly anticipating a walk on in and to be greeted with flowers and whatnot. In fact, there's just legions of stories about the soldiers being completely and utterly taken aback by the Ukrainian resistance. And I think that actually goes all the way back up to the top in just completely misreading the situation and what the Ukrainians were going to do and how they were going to resist. But I do completely agree with you that it is, you know, the Eastern Band and then the whole southern coast that really is very important strategically. And I'm not sure that, you know, the Russians have completely given up on that hope. You know, when you listen to the propaganda and some of the stuff that's coming out, you know, they very much still talk about wanting Odessa as you know, within their realm. And if you just sort of follow Odessa along the coast and exactly to your point over towards Moldova, you know, Moldova still kind of got its own little ripples of anxiety and with the Russian presence there, it is not abated. It is still an issue. It's a low simmering one. So I'm not sure that they have taken that off the table, but they do continue at this point right now, the pushes towards Kharkiv. That's where the current offensive is really going on. And so we'll see. But you're correct that a lot of the economic drivers of Ukraine are sort of concentrated in the east and then down along the coast is the shipping lines.
And let's turn back to economic resilience, because, of course, in the first couple of months of the war, it was difficult for people to adapt in that sort of mass refugee stage. But I think Ukrainians, as we know, one, are extremely hardworking, but they're also adaptable and innovative and extraordinarily resilient, despite what's going on, despite the psychological, emotional trauma of it. I know so many who are sort of working through and still doing, you know, day jobs. How important was it that quite quickly many Ukrainians were able to establish themselves as remote workers and plug back into the economy, even if they weren't physically present in Ukraine? And then, of course, we also saw the phenomenon, despite the electricity cuts in that first winter, of people still being able to put in, you know, a reasonable number of hours of work despite the hardships and interruptions.
Yeah, so this may sound strange, but I think actually COVID in some ways was a really important preparation for being able to work remotely and being able to adapt to changing situations. And, you know, Ukraine, just like everywhere else, you know, went through its own adjustment when people started doing the work from home kind of thing. And it really served the Ukrainians very well in terms of being able to adapt and pick up. That was particularly true within the tech sector, and we call it more maybe the service industries. It's a little bit harder in terms of manufacturing or something like that. But you're absolutely spot on that the Ukrainians really did respond very quickly. And it was everything from you know, this move out to the West, where it was away from the immediate threat that was going on in Kiev, but people were integrated into a lot of the, not just the large cities in the West, like Lviv, but into smaller ones, you know, all the way down and even on the backside of the Carpathian Mountains. So it was the ability to psychologically be able to make the shift quickly, to having had the experience of doing remote team working. Things like having access to Starlinks were absolutely critical because it gave people access to the internet, you know, even if there were blackouts that were going on. And again, to the point earlier, is people really felt like it was important to continue doing business as normal. Nobody wanted to be seen as sort of falling apart in the context of this happening, because it was essentially, you know, Ukraine wanting to deliver on services and goods and things that they had provided, you know, that they had pledged to provide through their businesses. And I think that was an incredibly important piece of it, of the wanting to deliver on work that had been promised. And so that you know, absolutely was a big piece of all of that.
Now, foreign investors are by nature perhaps a lot more cautious than Ukrainians would be, who have become used to living under duress, who have become used to living with a portion of their country in a state of warfare. And that's not just going back, obviously, to February 2022. That's 10 years of Russian aggression, 10 years of a Russian attempt to turn Ukraine into an economic, political and social basket case. And each attempt seems to have actually had the opposite impact. But foreign investors are by nature far more cautious. And of course, it's difficult to get the sort of insurance that are required for, you know, sending your people to work on site, or insurance around, you know, various business insurance for businesses operating. So what are the challenges here, and what is the reaction of Western business? Is it deterring a lot of inbound investment?
So I think there's two different ways to look at this. So for the Western companies that were in Ukraine before this started, a majority of them are still here, are still doing business. And these are companies that actually had very often, you know, been through, like you said, sort of the last 10 years. Many of them were here 2014. And so they have sort of seen the Ukrainian resilience and the ability to continue to do business even under very adverse situations. To the point where for existing businesses, I mentioned that the economy is still growing. It is still, you know, it is still humming along. And in the context of being able to continue to sell products and services, that is absolutely still going on. So there's that piece of it. Where it gets harder, I think, is for companies or investors who are thinking about Ukraine for new FDI or foreign direct investment. And FDI generally means that it's not investing in the context of you're giving money and somebody, you know, like within the tech sector, you're investing in a company and they're doing the work. With FDI investment, it usually includes building of new facilities, bringing in, you know, management from the outside. And you're right that right now it is a harder decision for a lot of companies to make, you know, about coming into Ukraine. The question of war risk insurance is absolutely one that is discussed quite frequently here. There have been some instances of where war risk insurance had been secured. Actually, I think the British had helped with some of the war risk insurance for some of the grain that had been shipped out. But in the context of the building of new facilities, things like that, manufacturing plants, the few companies that are coming in and have come in, I believe that they are looking for private sourcing of finding insurance. But I can guarantee you it is much, much, much more expensive than it normally would be.
And which are the sectors, because I know you're very involved in the tech sector, which are the sectors that are more likely to get that inbound investment? Is it the more traditional agriculture, exporting, etc., heavy industry? Is it military industrial complexes? A lot of stories about various investment coming in, and maybe that sector is a little less worried about the fact that there's a hot war going on. I imagine, you know, they it's par for the course for many of those, like Rheinmetall and others. Or is it the tech sector that is attracting the most?
So it kind of runs the gamut. And each one is a slightly different story, I guess. So traditionally, if you look at what were the really big economic drivers of the Ukrainian economy overall, agriculture is absolutely up there at the top. There's also metallurgy, manufacturing with the more industrial scale. There is also the tech sector in the context of service exports. And each of these have sort of been impacted a little bit differently, I guess. I don't think, so some of the manufacturing that had previously been located in the East has moved to space in the West of Ukraine. So some of the Ukrainian companies have moved to the West to places that are a little bit less vulnerable to shelling and attacks, things like that. In the context of new, we'll call it Western FDI coming in, there is not a lot at this point. There is a tremendous amount of interest. I do talk to Westerners who come in and are doing, I'll call them almost scouting trips to understand, location, situation, that sort of thing. So there are people that are looking, but it has definitely dropped in terms of, it has both dropped and I would say it's on hold. It's kind of a steady state. And I think really what people are waiting for is a clear indication of some sort of end before there is this big rush in. Overall, I think when this ends, there is going to be a tremendous amount of money that comes into the country, and it's going to be, there's a lot that needs to be rebuilt in terms of housing sector, in terms of hospitals, schools, infrastructure, roads, you name it, all of that is going to have to be redone. So there's a lot of opportunity that is coming in the future. And so with that piece, we'll stop with that. In the tech sector, it's a little bit different because the tech sector has been able to be much more mobile. It is not tied to a physical location. And there is both the traditional tech things that are going on. So that's outsourcing first and foremost. There is a large and growing startup ecosystem. And then the third piece that is really growing and booming, which is the area that we are looking at, is more or less in the defense tech sector. And we can talk a little bit more about that in detail.
And it's a difficult challenge at the moment, isn't it? Because mobilization legislation has only recently passed, but it's extremely urgent, and yet it is kind of difficult to create that balance, especially in a country that is a democracy, a country that does have to respect human rights, rule of law, etc. It's a difficult balance. But there's another equation here, isn't there, which is that the war effort is extremely dependent on the economy continuing to grow and the revenue it provides. And you don't want to suck out too much resource and expertise from that economy because, well, we'll come on to this in a minute, the civilian and war economy are now fusing and merging, and one can't survive without the other.
So, yes, you're correct. So the new mobilization law actually just came into effect yesterday. A big piece of it is they had dropped the age from 27 down to 25. And it is absolutely a balance that they are trying to find in the context of finding and being able to deploy more people out to the front. But at the same time, really being mindful of the fact that there is and could be an impact on the economy. One of the challenges right now for the economy overall is the availability of personnel. And with this new mobilization law, there is some anxiety about how that is going to even sort of exacerbate that problem. In the context of, I'll call it the innovation and the especially within the technology sector and how it is interplaying and working with what's happening on the front line, one of the things that's sort of important to remember is that a lot of actually what is happening on the front right now is the continued integration of technology into how this battle is being fought. And so while there are absolutely incredibly, it's very important, obviously, that the traditional military kit continues to come into Ukraine and to support in terms of the Patriots and HIMARS and artillery shells and things like that. But the other piece of the way that this battle is being fought is that it is very increasingly around UAVs, so unmanned aerial vehicles, unmanned ground vehicles. Even there are some unmanned sea vehicles that have been used in the Black Sea. And all of these new ways of fighting back in terms of the drone warfare and the more robotic warfare is being driven largely by people who have been coming out of the Ukrainian tech sector. You know, overall, Ukraine has had a really strong tradition in terms of the STEM technology within the university system. So it's the science, tech, engineering, and mathematics. And so just as a baseline, this is actually a very highly educated country within those particular areas. And it is one of the things that has driven the growth of the tech sector outside of the military situation, but it is also what is driving a lot of the technology integration that is happening out on the battlefield. You know, there have been periods during this war where there were lulls of some of the shipments coming in of supplies from Western allies and partners. And one of the things that has really helped the Ukrainians hold the line is just really innovative uses of technology, particularly within the drone space, of holding the line and being able to keep the Russians at bay in that context.
Well, this is the next topic we're really going to talk about, and it's one that absolutely fascinates me. And this is the innovation cycle in tech that leads to innovations in military tactics. Well, neither of us are, you know, military people, but you're very close to seeing what's happening and how, I would say, the, you know, the startup and scale up attitude that you would get in the tech sector, you know, whether that's Silicon Valley or you know, parts of the UK or wherever you have these concentrations of tech entrepreneurs, you get these incredibly fast feedback loops between, you know, prototyping, testing, deployment. But then you have this important bit, don't you, where you scale up and reduce the unit cost. Now, this is a very big kind of question here, but I'm fascinated in how this is moving in Ukraine and how this is driving innovation in warfare at an almost unprecedented speed.
So I'm going to start at the beginning, but I love the back end of your question because it's a really, really important one, not just here, but it's got longer term ramifications. So before the war, the Ukrainian startup ecosystem had really taken off after 2014 and after Maidan. And it from, I think it was 2015, actually, where it started up until just before the war, this sector was growing at about 28% per annum. So there was a really big upswing in the context of the startup ecosystem. Within that period, you know, there had been no Ukrainian unicorn companies, you know, as of 2014. By end of 2023, there were eight companies that had hit, you know, unicorn status. Ukraine has also been long known as just a tremendous source of back-end development teams. So everybody in the tech sector in the United States knows the Ukrainian dev teams and the quality of what they are able to do. So there's a strong base in technology. This didn't sort of come from nowhere. And what has happened is in the context of trying to help and support what's going on out at the front, the tech sector has really sort of stepped in and been able to fill a lot of gaps. So there is incredible development that is going on. And it is one of the things that's really important to understand, it's very need-based focused. So these are guys who are calling their brothers, their cousins, their classmates who are out at the front saying, what do you need? And then people all over the rest of Ukraine are building to the need. And so that makes both the technology not only new, but it's very precise to how to help, you know, the Ukrainians continue to win and defend out on the front line. So it's very targeted technology, and it's all in the, we'll call it the defense base. And you mentioned a couple of these. So it's not just the aerial vehicles themselves. It is also, you know, broadly in the category of electronic warfare. Within that, it's both, you know, there's two sides to detecting things floating, you know, overhead. It's both the detection and then the mitigation. And the Ukrainians are really going full speed in both of those areas, because in addition to the close contact line, one of the other things is that the Russians have also been using drones. You know, one of the biggest things to terrorize Ukraine as a, you know, across the entire country are the Shahad, the Iranian made Shahad drones. And right now, there's not great ways to take them down. The Ukrainians have innovated in a, I'll call it a low-tech fashion. Actually, the thing that they have been most successful with taking the Shahads down are actually using World War II machine guns, believe it or not. But that is not, you know, the best solution. So everybody in this country right now is who has any familiarity with this space are really focused on how do you start protecting from drones, because the drones really are changing sort of the nature of this. And it is both letting the Russians hit the civilian areas as well as critical infrastructure, energy stations, things like that. But it's also, it's got the impact on the front line as well.
And there's glide bombs as well, aren't there? And I guess there isn't an adequate solution to that at the moment, using, you know, £200,000 or dollar, you know, Patriots and advanced missile systems is actually not an economic viable balance there to take out these fairly relatively primitive but effective and cheap munitions.
Yeah. So to the point that you had made earlier about kind of there's been this economic shift or this rebalancing, one of the things that is really important to understand is there's now $400 drones that have been modified to carry some kind of munition that they are now able to use through FPV, you know, with first person, very direct targeting, and they're taking out hundreds of thousands, if not million-dollar pieces of equipment using a $400 drone that has been modified. And this is just every day in, day out. And it is to the point, one, these are very difficult to destroy. And two, they are very easy, you know, they're very easy to make, and you can make a lot of them. And so a sort of what has happened is it's both rapid, you know, production and then the rapid iteration as something shifts. So if there is something, some new tactic that is being used in terms of, you know, spoofing or jamming, things like that, people are then responding in terms of how these are programmed, and then they send it back out to the front line to see if it's working. And so this is all sort of happening in parallel to what you would might think of as more traditional military fighting, but you now have this whole other layer of this electronic drone warfare that is going on, you know, in conjunction with your bigger, you know, 155 shells heading overhead.
What's fascinating about this is you're building a picture here of a highly unconventional sort of innovation and manufacturing cycle at scale. So this isn't incumbent on central government to plan the need, to understand the need. You've got tech entrepreneurs talking to people at the front, iterating, developing, communicating at scale, building stuff, testing it, scaling it up, getting the unit cost down. At no point do you see me here? And of course, then the fundraising, a lot of that fundraising is also not done through central government. It's done through civic society and those sort of structures that we're very familiar with. This is a totally different paradigm. And I'm going to throw the sort of challenging question out here that Western militaries are light years away from being able to replicate this process or even understand why it's important.
I completely agree with you. So there's sort of two parallel ways that this is both happening and getting all of this equipment out to the front. It actually started, as you said, sort of in the volunteer space. This was not central government order down. What was starting to happen were units out at the front were calling and saying, hey, can you crowdfund a Mavic for me? I need, you know, surveillance drones. And it started, you know, literally from the surveillance level of just being able to understand what was happening. But as the drones got out to the front, they realized, I can actually do a little bit of jury rigging with this, and I can send a hand grenade over that way. And it has just kind of escalated and escalated. And a lot of this, and by mean escalation, I mean both in terms of the innovation and the complexity of what they're doing, as well as the sophistication of it. And then also, but in the context of just wider usage. So there is this, we'll call it crowdsourced pipeline of equipment that is fairly highly technical, that is going out to the front lines. But in parallel, there has been some very good steps that the government has taken to be able to respond to this and to integrate this into sort of the more traditional structure of Ministry of Defense and General Staff. So last summer, Minister of Digital Transformation, Mikhail Fedorov, announced the creation of what they called an army of drones. And at that point, they had already seen what was happening out on the front, and they decided that they really did need to start doing something within the government to sort of standardize and continue this whole production. I think last year, their goal had been something like 5,000 drones or whatnot that they wanted to be able to do through official channels and put them out to the front. This year, beginning of the year, Zelensky had announced that they were looking for 1 million drones to be produced. So the scale has increased tremendously. Now, this also includes all different kinds of drones, including the really small FPV ones that are literally everybody is involved with, not everybody, an awful lot of people in Ukraine are involved in the production and putting these together. And I'll just give you an example. The woman who repairs my jewelry and replaces my watches and who is used to working with small precision in her spare time, when she doesn't have clients, she is putting together FPV drones that are going to be sent out to the front. And so the size of all of this is quite large. In the context also of the government side and how they have tried to sort of manage this, they last summer stood up an initiative called Brave One. And Brave One has sort of become the portal through which all the new technology is brought in, is evaluated, reviewed. If it makes it past the first few steps, then they determine with the general staff to make sure that this is something that is needed. Then it moves to the field testing stage, and then it can move to procurement stage if it kind of passes all of this sort of due diligence process. This is something that if you ask the Department of Defense to do, it would probably take, I don't know, 3 years might be conservative, probably more along the lines of 5 years. Here it's taking 3 to 5 months. And it is a complete and utter paradigm change in the context of the government being able to identify the new technology that is needed, identify sources that can deliver it, and issuing procurement orders, you know, in super fast turnaround. And it's incredibly impactful that they have done this, because it allows for the both getting new technology out to the front as quickly as possible, but it is also, you know, helping them understand, rather than, you know, 200 different individual drone makers who are putting stuff out to the units directly, and they're not really tracking, or, you know, there's not necessarily always coordination between the technology. And so you can't say, hey, this one has got this better, that one's got that better. As you are running it through the more official channel, what it helps them do is to really identify the different aspects that are really working well. And I'll just give you an example. So with the drone, there are some drone manufacturers. There are now more than 250 drone manufacturers actually in Ukraine. There were 7 before the war. Most of them were agriculture drones. But of these 250, a lot of them are doing full tip-to-tail drones, which means they are putting together not just the body and the engine, but they're also doing the software, the optics, the cameras, the radar detection, things like that. Not everybody is equal in all of the different components in the drones. And really what the ideal state to get to is to understand, okay, this one's got the best body, this one's got the best software, this one has got the best EW jamming, that kind of thing. And so with the government having gotten to the point where there's now a pipeline, that actually gives them an advantage. And again, to your point, Western governments are nowhere near being able to iterate this quickly.
And another interesting aspect, I remember this from an interview with Ukrainian entrepreneur towards the start of the war, innovation ahead of legislation is quite an important factor here as well, because We know that the Ukrainian legislative system, but also its judicial system, this is one of the slowest areas to adapt and change following Maidan. And if we were to wait until legislation was available to cover the kind of technologies and innovations and manufacturing that we've been talking about, of course, it would never happen. Now, that's not unique to Ukraine, though. I mean, I think Western democracies, the UK as well, legislation is quite slow to catch up with challenges, especially we'll come to disinformation in a minute. But how important is it that the entrepreneurial mindset of, you know, move fast, break things, and don't wait for the law to catch up? How important is that?
I don't think they're even worrying about the law catching up per se. I think that what they are doing is moving fast and breaking things, making sure that they can get whatever is needed out there as quickly as possible. You know, some of these things, I'm not even sure that there was anything within the legislation around them. I mean, that's how much certain things have sort of leapfrogged. But it has really been key to one of the reasons that the Ukrainians have been able to, you know, hold off the Russians and push back the Russians to the degree that they have. There's a really special thing about Ukrainian society in that they don't always wait for orders from the top to be told what the right thing to do is. And within the military, yes, but within civilian society, you know, you could even see that in the response that happened when the Russians first came towards Kiev. You know, the Minister of Interior essentially opened the armory gates, armed citizens, and, you know, out they went to the northern and western corners. And it is that ability and that intrinsic sense and need, you know, understanding of a need for action without waiting for somebody to tell you what to do, has really played a very critical part of Ukraine's ability to survive. And you see it, you know, to some degree on you know, the economic side as well, just even within the tech sector and the innovation. People are not looking for you know, give us the right thing. They're willing to go figure it out on their own and to move it forward. So at some point, yes, the legislation, the legal structures, things like that are going to catch up, and they should, absolutely. But until that point, I think that the approach that has been taken and what they are doing is really part of what has been the key to how they have been able to hold for so long.
And one of the surprising things, certainly for me coming to Lviv, and that was my first trip to Ukraine in August of last year, was how much construction is going on. You know, business parks, tech parks, of the highest quality, with really, you know, really well designed, strategically laid out, thought out, clearly, you know, very high building standards. It's extraordinary in a time of war. You know, they had this particular street scene where you had a tech park that was as good as, if not better than anything I've seen in the UK. And on the road outside, you had hedgehogs from the Second World War, you know, the anti-tank defences. Mm-hmm. An extraordinary, I'd almost call it sort of cyberpunk kind of world.
Yeah. Well, Ukraine is a place of a lot of juxtapositions these days. I mean, really, you know, it is exactly what you said. And to the point, you know, I was trying to make earlier, that this understanding that the country has to continue moving forward economically, and in the context of, you know, these tech parks coming online, all of these things continuing to move forward. But then the realities of the situation is that hedgehogs are actually kind of important in case the Russians come back. And you even see that in the center of Kiev. You know, in many ways, life here is far more normal than I think that most of the West understands it to be. Every single day, people get up, they get on the metro, they go to work, they take their children to school. Cafes, restaurants, things like that are all full. But at the same time, the restaurants are across from the hedgehogs or the concrete blocks. There are still guard posts, you know, at most of the roads coming in and out of Kiev. So it's this just these two seemingly different but very real worlds that we all here are living in every single day. And I think actually one of the things that for me being here is just sort of really fascinating to watch about how you can incorporate all of these things into your experience, even though, you know, they seem to be worlds apart. But when you are in a situation where you really just need to keep things moving and deal with the realities of what is versus what you might wish them to be, it just becomes the new normal. You know, right now there's Ukraine is facing rolling blackouts because the Russians have taken out so many of the particularly the substations and the relay stations, and rolling blackouts just become part of the new normal. You don't complain about it. You don't worry about it. They do their best to, you know, they publish, there's lists where you can check your address and it says, okay, we estimate that the blackout in your area is going to be between these 2 hours. And so you plan to do your cooking or your laundry or whatever you need for your electricity. You charge your phones, you know, before, after those hours, but you just get on with it. And it's just part of what you do to continue to support in any way, you know, what's happening, and whether it's at the national level or the, you know, for the front.
Well, the last area I want to sort of focus on, bring some of these themes together. Ukraine is right there at the sharp end. They're reacting in lightning speed to what's going on, innovating and so on. If we look, however, at the West, and this is very, very broad, I understand, we don't seem to have that same sense of speed, that same sense of existential threat. And yet Russia is weaponizing everything. Information, disinformation, culture, language, sport, economy, energy, everything in Russian hands is a weapon. How do we need to develop, I would say, this Ukrainian mindset in order to fight this sort of multi-channel, multi-pronged aggression? And the particular topic I'm interested in is technology to fight disinformation. And again, it seems that Ukraine is now at the forefront of innovating in the sort of cyber and disinformation sphere as well. How are we going to wake up, and how quickly do we need to do that?
Boy, from your lips to certain presidents' ears, that they would wake up. In the context of, you know, the Ukrainians, the Ukrainians have they understand the Russian mentality very well. They, you know, first under the Russian Federation, then absolutely, you know, during the course of the Soviet Union, and then even in the post-Soviet space, the tactics, the goals, the methodology that the Kremlin uses to advance its objectives, Ukrainians just know it very well. And so in the context of being able to respond to it, both militarily and then also, you know, in the information space, they are really well positioned to actually be pushing back on this. And in the context of this, obviously, it is a defense of the Ukrainian territory, but when you get into what you're talking about, which is the cyberspace, there's no boundaries in cyberspace. And so what the Russians are able to do through cyber attacks, through disinformation, and through almost this psychology of propaganda that just makes people not, you know, to a point where nobody knows what is true and what is false. The Russians absolutely are impacting everybody. And I'm not exaggerating that there's no boundaries within this space. And so the fact that with some of the new technology that the Ukrainians are working on, a lot of it is using AI, being able to both be able to identify and push back, it is an important step, you know, in the way in going forward, because these threats from Russia are not going to end. They will probably intensify. And as to how to make the West wake up, I don't know. You know, before we had started talking, I mentioned, you know, I think your platform is incredibly important, because what you are doing is you are bringing together all of these different pieces and helping explain all of these different aspects of Russian aggression. And yes, at this point, it really is focused, you know, Ukraine is kind of the nucleus of it, but Russia is, their view is to sow and create disorder everywhere, you know, within Western democracies. And they're not bombing, you know, in Western Europe or the United States, but they are doing as much as they possibly can to sow confusion, disorder, distrust. And it's not even just on a political level, it's, you know, person to person level. And so it is absolutely a challenge. And I think that the other piece that is on the horizon is just with this really fast iteration of what's going on in ChatGPT and usage of AI, and you know how some of these things are evolving. It's going to get really hard really quickly, you know, through online conversations to know if you are speaking with a human or with a bot. I mean, that is how good some of this AI is getting. And there really does need to be an awareness in the West, because if we are not careful, just, you know, what at this point, you know, I think you and I can kind of see is a huge amount of disinformation coming out of Russia is just going to be a deluge even more so.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm about to, it's interesting you mentioned that, I'm about to do a couple of episodes on the channel in the coming month on AI, election interference, and, you know, with my day job hat on as a commercial propagandist, it's my view that AI is going to be a tsunami of stuff, corrosive information, and we are not even, you know, we're not even aware that we need to be aware of what we need to do about it. That's another sort of topic we're going to add to the channel. I think it's incredibly important to cover that. This has been sort of absolutely fascinating. We've touched upon so many topics which are extremely close to my interests. So I'm very grateful for what you're doing there in Ukraine, helping it to remain resilient through investment and innovation, and very grateful you could join me on the channel as well.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. And again, thanks to you. What you are doing is important, you know, for all Ukrainians, continuing to share this. So thank you very much.